Willkommen zu Das ist Kunst, dem Podcast der Deichtorhallen Hamburg. Ich bin Jumoke Olusanmi. Schön, dass ihr dabei seid. In dieser Ausgabe spreche ich mit Ken Schless. Der ist Fotograf und Autor und hat in den 80er Jahren das Leben im New Yorker Stadtteil East Village dokumentiert. Diese Arbeiten erschienen in dem Fotoband Invisible City, der vielfach ausgezeichnet wurde. Anlass für unser Gespräch ist die Ausstellung High Noon. Die ist derzeit in den Deichtorhallen in Hamburg zu sehen, und in dieser Ausstellung zeigen Fotografien von Nan Goldin, David Armstrong, Mark Morris Rowe und Philip Lawker die Korschier das Leben der New Yorker Subkultur in den 80er Jahren der Reagan-Ära. Auch Ken Schless war damals Teil dieser Szene.
You'd hear about people dying from violence. You'd hear about people dying from AIDS. There was a massive pandemic that was going on that was not being acknowledged by the mainstream. And Ronald Reagan at the time refused to even say the word AIDS.
Im Gespräch geht es um die Faszination, die noch immer vom New Yorker East Village ausgeht. Ein Ort, der in den 80er Jahren geprägt war von sozialen Problemen und gleichzeitig Zentrum der kulturellen Avantgarde. Ich habe mich mit Ken Schless per Videocall unterhalten, deshalb variiert die Audioqualität. Wir bitten, das zu entschuldigen. Das Gespräch haben wir auf Englisch geführt.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. I'm in the borough that I was born in, I guess, close to 65 years ago. I moved to Fort Greene from the East Village, in 1997.
We already got into New York. Have you ever lived in another place?
Not really for an extended period of time. Not more than a few months.
So where did you grow up?
I was born on a dirt road in, far out in South Brooklyn. I guess it's almost mythological to think that there were dirt roads in Brooklyn. But I remember we lived, there were six of us in a two-bedroom apartment. I was in the same bedroom as my parents and a brother of mine. And I had two other brothers that shared a bedroom. Come from very humble background, working class family. And then we moved to South Queens in the mid 60s. And it was a tumultuous time in the city's history. It started losing its industrial base. And it was a period of the flight of the middle class out of the city. But for my family, it was an opportunity to buy a house for the first time. The real estate agents were doing this thing called blockbusting, where they were going into neighborhoods and they were doing race baiting, and they were trying to scare the population into moving and selling their houses. So it was part of this sort of white flight. It was also during the time of the Great Migration of blacks coming up from the South. And the cities were changing in their complexion. But there was a lot of fear baiting around that, and real estate agents were using it as a way to lower real estate prices for sellers, and so they could go in and exploit neighborhoods and cause disruption. My family, being very poor to begin with, I guess, used it for their benefit, and they were able to buy a house for the first time.
Because who lived there before? What was South Queens? Who was there?
It was white, predominantly white, middle class. By the time I graduated from elementary school, I was the only white kid in my class.
Okay, right.
So the neighborhood had totally shifted, and my neighborhood it's still called Laurelton. And it was considered like this demarcation line. And there was activity by the KKK on Long Island. It was this time of racial turmoil in the city. A lot of times we hear about the freedom fighters in the South, but, New York, for all of its liberal affectations, was highly segregated. And there was a lot of violence around the segregation. There was a family in the neighboring neighborhood, Rosedale, which a black family moved into a house, and their home was firebombed.
And that was in the 60s in New York?
Yeah, and that's when we moved in there. So I think this sort of social turmoil, I guess, has sort of followed me throughout my life.
When did you move from Queens to the East Village?
Well, I actually had a little sojourn into the suburbs of New York. I mean, the schools were getting, in New York City, were getting pretty violent also during that period. And there were safety issues that I was experiencing in school, being a minority. I was repeatedly targeted. It's really interesting because we think of, like, today there's a lot of rhetoric around and dislocation and violence and political discussion. But this period in the 1960s, there was a lot of stuff going on that was really violent. And the violence filtered down also because of the drug trades and the wars that were happening on the street for territory. So my parents did do the escape to the suburbs, which to me was incredibly dislocating.
How old were you then?
I was 12. And they said that one of the reasons why they moved was because they couldn't understand my English anymore.
Oh, wow.
I had started talking with a kind of an inner city patois, you might say. Which is funny because I don't have, you know, people say I don't have a New York accent. I don't have a very pronounced accent.
Because of that time, you think? That you kind of relearned English?
I relearned English, maybe. I don't know. But I moved to what was predominantly a white enclave. And I felt really dislocated. I tried to identify with the people of color that lived in that were going to my school, but I couldn't really identify them because their experience was a suburban experience. And it was a really strange time for me. So I lived in the suburb for 5 years. When I was 17, I got into art school, went to Cooper Union down on the Bowery, and I moved back to New York City.
Well, we came together to also speak about a special period of time in the 80s in New York, also because there is a big exhibition in Germany, in the Deichtorhallen in Hamburg, which is focusing on works by photographers like Nan Golden and David Armstrong, Mac Morris Rowe, and Philip Lorca de Corsia, who documented lives in the New York subculture in the 80s, which you also did. You're younger than them, but you also experienced this very special period of time in New York. You had very different experiences, I guess, than coming from the suburbs and moving the suburbs of New York and moving back to the city, especially the East Village. How was that different or shocking or, I don't know, rejuvenating or...
I moved to the East Village in 1978. It was a year after the blackout and riots of 1977.
Can you tell us a little bit about the blackout? What happened and what did that mean for New York at that time?
All I know is, you know, the infrastructure was failing in New York City. There was a cascading blackout that put the whole city into darkness. And during that darkness, there was the city kind of went wild, and there were riots and looting across the city. The city was kind of the place where all of the hatred of New York came to a head, where people outside of New York who said that it was this wild, lawless place, they felt that their evaluations of New York were justified and vindicated in this, what was really kind of a night of terror for a lot of people. For other people, it was a kind of liberation and joy, where they just went and they destroyed the businesses that they felt were exploiting their communities. This vision of what New York was as this lawless horror show was you know, was embedded in the minds of most Americans at that point. New York was vilified, hated. But of course, you know, New York has a longer history that embraces the immigrant and embraces diversity and embraces progressive attitudes, left-wing attitudes, anarchist attitudes. And that was hated by the mainstream media, the mainstream business culture that was alive in America at the time. So as an artist living there, you had an incredible amount of freedom because you didn't have these stifling structures around you.
Were you aware of that when you moved to New York? Was that attractive to you? Is that something you were looking for?
As a high school student, I'd go with friends and we'd go and ride the subways and we'd we'd come down to New York City for concerts or whatever, because it was so close. And we were always told, you know, be careful, it's really dangerous. We never had problems, but we always had a lot of fun, and it was, you know.
So you wanted to be there?
I wanted to be there, and I got into art school, and, you know, we were already listening to, you know, the first signs of the punk movement were coming out in 77, so it was right before I moved down there. You know, CBGB's had opened up.
CBGB's a music club.
The music club, yeah. So already, you know, Talking Heads, and I knew what was going on and knew some of the people. I couldn't afford to go to the clubs, like the Mud Club. I had a roommate who was going to the Mud Club every night, and he would talk about meeting this, you know, band called the B-52s, and they're great people, and they're really good, became good friends of his. And I was like, I can't afford the cover charge to get into the club. And I was still scrounging for food. And, you know, I had no money. I had no support from my family because, I was a second generation immigrant, and my family, it was like, you know, you don't go into the arts. You become a professional. You go to college.
Where does your family come from?
My parents were the children of immigrants from Eastern Europe who came around the turn of the last century or before, late 1800s, early 1900s. The only story I know about my grandfather is he escaped the pogroms of in Latvia, where the White Russian army they'd come in and they would take the Jewish youth and forcefully conscript them to a lifetime in the White Russian army, and they'd become the fodder for the cannons. And so he escaped to America.
You decided to go to art school without their permission then?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, all my other brothers had become professionals, engineers or doctors or computer scientists.
So Cooper Union it was?
Well, it was free, so I could afford it.
Yeah.
That was the other thing. I couldn't, you know, I was getting no support from my family, so it was a way for me to, I still had to come up with the rent, which was really hard. So I worked at the Strand Bookstore, which was another melting pot for the arts community.
The Strand Bookstore in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Does it still exist?
Oh, yeah. It still exists.
It does.
And they're still going on strike against the owners. Patty Smith worked there, you know, just before I started working there. She decided to become a full time musician. It was, I think, one of her last full time jobs.
Okay. So it was full of living history when you moved to New York with the Talking Heads and Patti Smith.
Yeah, yeah. And even before, I mean, you know, Marcel Duchamp lived in the village. The Dada movement had precursors in the village. You know, Emma Goldman lived in the village.
How come?
It was considered this place for the avant-garde, the radical. You know, the 10th Street artists in the 1940s, the Abstract Expressionist movement was founded in the village.
What infrastructure was there that it was so so attractive for young artists to go there?
Cheap rents and places. It was also very close to, you know, when I was living there, Soho, which had become deindustrialized, was dirt cheap. So you can get what were factory buildings for nothing. And a lot of artists had been moving into those spaces. And if you didn't have the money for that, you were living in the village. You know, Klaus Oldenburg had his famous storefront on 4th Street going into back in the 60s. So pop art started, you know, in the area. It was Andy Warhol was still around. You'd see him all over the place. You'd run into Allen Ginsberg. He lived on 12th Street. I lived on 12th Street. You know, you're just walking down the street and you'd run into history.
It seemed to be a very special part of New York, of Manhattan, of the south of Manhattan, right? I mean, New York is huge. But I mean, you already said it was cheap. It already had kind of a history, but was it so different? Like, did you experience?
Well, there were these small places, you know, in the village, there were all the folk clubs, the cafes, and no other part of the city. There was no other place in the city where there was this kind of cafe society. It just had this literary and artistic history, and also the physical infrastructure allowed for it. So
with the
old city went through the bottom, it still had, the buildings were still there. I mean, that's what I was always, when I was making my photographs, I was thinking, you know, these are the same buildings that Jacob Riis photographed in How the Other Half Lives, you know, when he was describing the plight of the immigrant class, you know, in the late 19th century. These are the same buildings. So the photographs, they have the same look. It's just the contents have shifted and the time has shifted and the attitude of the people living them perhaps had shifted. It was exciting to be living through this history because it just seeped into everything you were doing, everything you were seeing and experiencing. You know, I start off my book, Invisible City, with a quote from Lewis Mumford, and he talks about how the physical structure of a place imprints itself upon you, whether you're aware of it or not.
And were you aware of that by that time?
Yeah. Yeah.
And were you aware maybe that you were, that was a unique time in history and that it may weigh you maybe also in a way melancholic because you knew that it wouldn't last forever? Was there
we didn't know how it would turn out. So I don't know that we were so excited about it all because we were struggling for our lives. I mean, the crime at that point was through the roof, the number of rapes, the number of property crimes. The police wouldn't even come into the neighborhood. The heroin trade had taken over where I was living on Avenue B. The police wouldn't come east of First Avenue. They wouldn't come into Alphabet City, what was called Alphabet City.
So was it also stressful for
it was incredibly stressful. And life was cheap. Friends of yours would, you know, you'd hear about people dying from violence. You'd hear about people dying from AIDS. That was the other thing, was there was a massive pandemic that was going on that was not being acknowledged by the mainstream. And Ronald Reagan at the time refused to even say the word AIDS. And friends of mine were dying. You didn't know that it would become this. You had your community, I guess. You know, you had your friends. But there was a lot of pain, and it was not easy, and it was not fun for a lot of us. I'm always struck by people who would see my work and say, oh, yeah, I moved to the East Village. It's like such a cool place. It's, you know, like you can party. And I was like, I think what I was trying to show was that our lives were invisible. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't being recognized. We were dying. We were struggling.
I mean, we just talked about Cooper Union and how you wanted to become a painter. And then you're obviously a photographer now. Mm-hmm. So what was it that made you change your mind then? Was it what you just mentioned to show like what was happening in your community?
I felt myself very isolated in a painting studio. There was this world of pain and yearning and desire outside that was going on that was immediate. And I felt that I needed to be involved with that, that the painting was me being too reflexive. And I really wanted to bring the world into my work. And I still, you know, deeply believe this, that we experience the world individually in unique ways, all of us. And it's really important for us to speak about those personal truths, those personal experiences, and the ways there's so much that the media puts out, there's so much that the mainstream culture puts out, that tends towards a kind of conforming oppression that we need to fight against.
So who did you want to reach with these images, or you as a group of photographers, I'd say?
Well, I don't know that any of us really felt that we were going to get mainstream recognition. At least, I didn't have that expectation. I don't think that most people go into the arts for that. At least back then, I mean, there was really very little monetary compensation. It's a really different world than it was back then. I had been studying, the works of like Lucy Lepard, who had written a book called The Dematerialization of the Art Object. And it was also at that period, I was also studying with Hans Hacke. And there was a lot of discussion around the function of art as commodity. And a movement within the art world towards conceptualism to dematerialize the art object, to move it away from this commodity fetishism. I guess I also was curious about the way images are used to reinforce, I guess propagandize is really the best way to say it. I mean, I feel like images are used to propagandize ways of being, ways of existing in the world.
And so it was kind of your propaganda to show how you and your peers were living?
Yeah, to fight back a little bit, to push back and say, this is my truth, this is my reality. And to really try to be honest about what I was confronting and experiencing.
And was there also an intention to shock or to educate with your work? In a way?
I don't know about shock. People come to images with pre-existing notions and they bring their own ideas, their own prejudices to the image. So you may make an image, but it's going to be interpreted by someone perhaps in a very different way. So I wouldn't presuppose that people looking at my pictures would totally understand where I'm coming from with them. But because they are these open-ended objects, we can allow for other people to add to that understanding. And so it has that creative aspect that they bring to it.
Liebe HörerInnen, bevor es an dieser Stelle mit dem Gespräch weitergeht, möchte ich euch auf ein neues Format hinweisen, die Das ist Kunst-Shorties. Und um euch zu erklären, was es genau damit auf sich hat, sind Julia Schulze-Darup und Matthias Schönebäumer zu mir ins Studio gekommen. Hallo Julia, hallo Matthias.
Hallo Jumoke.
Hallo.
Ihr beiden moderiert ja die Shorties, aber was ist denn überhaupt ein Shorty?
Ja, du kennst es vielleicht, man hat Zeit und Lust auf Kunst, möchte eine Ausstellung in den Deichtorhallen besuchen, ist sich aber noch nicht so sicher, ob die Ausstellung denn wirklich überhaupt was für einen ist.
Meist stellen sich ja dann auch immer wieder dieselben Fragen. Also, wer sind eigentlich die KünstlerInnen? Worum geht's in der Ausstellung überhaupt? Und muss ich vor meinem Besuch irgendwas wissen?
Und genau diese Fragen beantworten wir in den Shorties. Und das natürlich kurz und knapp, wie der Name schon sagt.
Wann gibt es denn die neuen Shorties zu hören?
Die Shorties erscheinen zu jeder neuen Ausstellung in den Deichtorhallen. Sie sind also der perfekte Einstieg für den Ausstellungsbesuch. Und ihr findet sie überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Vielen Dank, Julia und Matthias, dass ihr vorbeigekommen seid. Und hier geht es jetzt weiter mit meinem Gespräch bei Das ist Kunst.
You already mentioned that people told you that they were like they decided to move to the East Village because of your photos.
And so I was shocked by that. I was like, no way. That is ridiculous.
Because there is like this romantic notion of, I don't know, bohemian artistic life. Dancing on the, how do you say, on on the edges in some way. You can see in your photos and also in photos of people of that period, which are, you're showing not really beautiful images, so to say, but they have this like really very attractive and romantic idea of New York in a way. And that's interesting that you say it's ridiculous for people to fall in love with these images.
Yeah. Well, there is this element of seduction with art, right? I mean, we do want people to look at the work. So we're seducing them to spend a little bit more time, to make, you know, to stop in their movement through the world, to take a moment to breathe and to look. And when you do that, a lot of times you fall in love. I mean, that happens with people. You spend time with someone and you look at them, you can fall in love with them.
Yeah, you discover things you haven't seen before or noticed before. Yeah.
So I think there's maybe that. And the materials are seductive. Let's not lie about that. I think we also, I don't want to say we romanticized what we were experiencing. I think we were trying to be honest about what we were experiencing. I think in all the artists that we're talking about today that are in the exhibition, I don't think any of them are trying to seduce the audience into thinking that this is like some cool thing that, you know, everyone should be engaging in. I think they're saying, this is something that's important that we should be paying attention to.
And did you have some kind of output also within this community in the East Village, for example? Did you have showing in galleries who was coming to look at these images? And did you get into conversation with the public, maybe? Or public?
I mean, at the time was also this period of flourishing because rents were cheap. People were opening up these storefront galleries, and I was part of that whole movement, and it was part of my community. It was you know, I know many, you know, I mean, Nan Golden especially was also showing around back then and in these same spaces.
What kind of spaces were they? How were they, like off galleries?
Yeah, they were these, you know, storefronts of tenements that used to be old grocery stores or tire shops or something. But most of the neighborhood was abandoned. I think you know, that's something, you know, we talked about what had happened in the riots, but we didn't talk about the aftermath of the riots.
The riots of the Blackout.
Yeah, in 77. The whole swaths of the city were just depopulated, especially commercially, maybe not fully physically, by, you know, there were still people living in a lot of the buildings, but also the landlords started torching their own buildings for the insurance money. You know, there's the Bronx is Burning is a very famous documentary about that whole period. That was happening in the Lower East Side as well. I mean, the cover of my book Invisible City is of a burning building, and it was before the internet, and we had no entertainment, so we'd gather outside around the burning buildings and watch fire trucks come and put the fires out. there was all this real estate that was just there for the taking. And I was part of a group of artists that started taking back that property. And so it made for, you know, the community to grow. So people started coming because they saw it as a place that where you can, you know, if not free, but really cheap rents, where you could afford to run a gallery that made absolutely no money. I know Fun Gallery made no money. You know, all the first East Village galleries, they made no money. So we would show the work, and it was mostly for us and our peers, and we'd show for each other, and we'd perform for each other. And I became very good friends with a group of performance artists. So the clubs were, you know, there was a place called APC, which was a favorite haunt, which was, they had bought the building for, I think it was $10,000, and the building itself had collapsed in on itself. And they were living in the upper floors on the edges where it hadn't collapsed. And on the first floor where you walked in, the first floor had collapsed into the cellar. And where the first floor still existed in the back, that became the stage because it was elevated above the cellar. And that became the performance space. And they were living, you know, I don't know how they would get up. And you'd look up and you'd see just these collapses.
That sounds really adventurous. So there was like a, like the different art disciplines also worked with it.
And for that, it was really exciting because, you know, I mean, there were all these different movements that were coming into being. You know, I mean, the gay rights movement was happening, ACT UP. I had friends who were very active in ACT UP.
The gay rights movement, like surging from the AIDS crisis.
And, yeah. So that was happening. The hip hop movement was happening in the neighborhood. It was happening down in the Lower East Side and in the Bronx. It was really happening right there. The sort of the no wave music scene was happening. Like Arto Lindsay and John Zorn, and the punk scene was starting out, and that was, you know, so all of these different, you know, Talking Heads. A lot of different, which now are considered discrete, separate art movements, really were all together in the same place, fomenting and interacting and sharing and crossing over.
And would you say that your photographs maybe have some beat or some sound or something? You would say, yeah, that was something like...
I mean, I definitely had a soundtrack that I was listening to at the time.
What was it? Do you still remember?
Yeah, I'm thinking of like the Butthole Surfers. And, so there was just a lot of crossover. So even like the artists, you know, who were in the show were involved in these things. It was crossing over with the mainstream art galleries and the performance stuff.
Was there a moment you were being aware that that was like slipping away or changing?
Yeah. And I think that's when I started putting my book Invisible City together, because I felt like the world was disappearing. That world was disappearing. A lot of money, the real estate interests started taking over. The clubs were getting more expensive. It started becoming about money.
When was that?
That was really in the late 80s. I mean, my book Invisible City was published in 88, and I had been working on putting it together as a book for a good year before that. So it was a very, it was a really brief flourishing, that was happening. And it got co-opted. The real estate prices were already high. I mean, I moved to Avenue B because it was one of the last few really cheap places that were available. And even then, it was really hard. I moved to Avenue B in 83, and it was really hard to, it was becoming really difficult to find cheap spaces.
Already then in the 80s. Okay.
Yeah. At least, you know, as cheap as I could afford, which was practically nothing.
Would you describe these changes as more as melancholic or more as brutal? How did you experience them emotionally?
I think those were the predominant emotions of the period, whether the changes were happening or not, because the changes were happening, they were ongoing from the start. I mean, people were dying from AIDS earlier on, so there was this constant melancholic overtone to things. Mm-hmm. The violence was still going on. You know, I had a lot of friends that were falling into heroin addiction, and there was a despair that was ongoing. You know, I think we can't separate that reality that was so oppressive to what was going on, and the co-option by real estate interests at the very end was the death knell. So it wasn't like this sudden, oh, they're taking over and this is horrible. It was like, oh, we have horrible, miserable existences, and here is yet another horrible thing that's destroying our whole community because we're becoming depopulated because of so many deaths And then they're just moving in and they're exploiting the look and feel of things and making a profit off of it.
I mean, you just recently had an exhibition in Amsterdam, and I was wondering, if you look at your work today, what has changed, or what is it you're looking at right now, and what maybe remained from this period in the 80s?
I mean, the work that I'm doing right now is centered around people who are activists. So it's movement work. People who are struggling to make change.
Struggling to make change in what?
Against the, you know, I guess I started working on this work after the election of Trump in 2016. So mostly starting around 2017, I've been working to this day. The work touched on healthcare issues, immigrant issues. More recently, I've been very deeply involved with environmental issues. And I feel the connection is very much similar to the work that I was doing back then, in that I'm not approaching it as an outsider photographing at protests. I'm one of the protesters documenting what's going on as a protester, as an organizer. It's come full circle from me first being interested and just photographing at actions to at this point where I'm involved with organizing the actions and involved with groups in a much more fundamental way. And it reminds me of the community that we had in the East Village, because it's people struggling to exist in the world, to be in the world, to make change in the world. So I feel like there's that connection and that flow through. There's so much to do here.
Thank you very much for your time, Ken.
Thank you. I enjoyed being able to speak with you. Thank you.
Seit über 40 Jahren begleitet Ken Schless mit kritischem Blick die sozialen und politischen Entwicklungen in seiner Heimatstadt New York. Themen und Debatten, die er in den 80er Jahren erlebt hat, sind noch immer aktuell. Das zeigt auch die Fotoausstellung High Noon in den Deichtorhallen in Hamburg. Mehr Informationen zu dieser Ausstellung von Nan Goldin, David Armstrong, Mark Morris Rowe und Philip Lorca, die Korshia, findet ihr in den Shownotes. Wenn euch der Podcast gefällt, freuen wir uns über eine positive Bewertung und empfehlt ihn sehr gerne weiter. Feedback könnt ihr per Mail an dasistkunst@deichtorhallen.de senden. Bis zur nächsten Folge von Das ist Kunst, dem Podcast der Deichtorhallen Hamburg in Zusammenarbeit mit Byte FM. Ich, Jumoku Ulusami, sage Danke und Tschüss.